So, I mean, Bill Forrester got beat by about 1,700 votes. And this new guy and his team won. So we had a new situation in our union, politically. The president who took over, a man named Al Grossberg, started off to try to read the riot act to a number of people who he felt had been his opposition. He was going to put them in line. He wasn't going to try to fire them because he says, well, okay, this was a wide open election, you could support your priest, but now I'm the president and you're going to have to support me. Well, he said it wrong. It kind of upset people. He had to be reminded in our meeting that he had with our staff after the election, you know, after the convention was over. And it fell on me because I didn't see anybody else doing it. I got up and I had reminded him that he was, everybody knew he was elected president. We weren't interested in the fact that he just won by a little vote or something. We knew he was president. He didn't have to remind us of that. And when he was doing his job as president, he'd get our support, but he earned political support. And this wasn't his union. This was the union of the people. He happened to be elected as its president, you know. Well, you know, that kind of moralizing don't make him as the new elected president feel very good. But, you know, he never held that against me. He and I became very good friends. And he subsequently named me as a director again. So he's retired now also. But when this new group came in, then we had some new forces. And conventions after that time became quite political as opposed to what they used to be. I'm not sure that was always bad. When Al Grossberg came in 65, and he left in 78, I believe. No, 78. He left the union in good, sound shape. He'd done a good job. He had consolidated it. He had made an attempt to, this is what really got me started in it. He had made an attempt to merge with the paper workers. He agreed that he would even step down as president so that that could take place. He said he would be not run. He'd turn it over to the other guy. Well, that would have had to have been the first step because the other guy, their union was larger than ours, and they felt they had the right to keep the presidency. And they had worked out the details pretty much, but our union rejected it. And, of course, as soon as we rejected, the paper workers took no action. Our union is a difficult one to merge with. There's too much individual pride into how we've written our Constitution, what it says, how it's supposed to work, what its theory of working is. Probably because we survived three separate periods. One, the union really started as a part of the AFL in 1917. Well, there had been some aborting attempts prior to that time, but it really got started in 1917. We were working under a jealously given industrial charter in the AFL. They didn't give charters to an industry, to a union to organize an industry. They gave charters to a craft or to a line of work. And because they did that, they showed very little interest in laborers or in operating personnel, people who operated in the refineries, because those weren't craft skills. So there was a number of people in the industry that they hadn't paid any attention to organize. They made attempts to organize the boilermakers, the pipe fitters, the machinists, the carpenters, the painters, those kind of jobs that could be identified as a skill that could be apprenticed, which was really their guidelines. So when we formed our union, even though, as I say, the reason is a jealously given charter, industrial charter, they gave us jurisdiction to organize the whole industry, but every time we went to an AFL convention as a union, each of these craft unions tried to reach in and grab their jurisdiction from us, and so we were constantly trying to defend our right to stay as an industrial union. And this went on from the time our union was formed until finally we got to the time when a number of the more industrial-type unions within the AFL-CIO, the rubber workers, the clothing workers, the mine workers, the oil workers, it wasn't steel workers or auto workers in those days, they weren't organized. See which ones I've missed. Anyway, there was six unions that met to develop a cooperative organization to fight the constant of the Committee of for Industrial Organization, CIO, the Committee of Industrial Organization to start with, in 35. Well, they got into some battles. They didn't intend to leave the AFL. They just intended to be this part of and have this side, like the industrial union portion of the AFL-CIO, where they could do their organizing and their bargaining and things in a little different way. And, of course, John L. Lewis was the key figure in most of this. He was the most powerful figure. Amalgamated Clothing Workers and the Ladies' Garment Workers, that was the two unions. I was thinking of them as one, as they are now. But they forced us out, the AFL did, finally. They said, we either had to go along with their rules or out you go. So they really, in a sense, expelled us. And then they formed the Congress of Industrial Organizations. And it was after the Congress was formed and started to operate, is when, and with John L. Lewis as the president, Phil Murray, who was out of the mine workers, also was his secretary treasurer of it, and the oil workers. When we started, the guy who was president of our union at the time, a man by the name of Harvey Fleming, was a very brilliant man. Came from Ventura, by the way. He was an electrician. When he was working, he had an opportunity to become the secretary treasurer, but he was not in good health, so he turned it down. So Phil Murray, who was John L.'s assistant, kind of came over and took that part, but was neither here nor there, except that our union was quite highly respected for the fact that it had fought hard all these years to maintain some semblance of industrial unionism within the AFL. And then, of course, is when John L., and nobody really knows how he did it, except that he had some meetings with some of the top people in steel and organized the steelworkers between a meeting between John L. and the head of the Bethlehem Steel, United States Steel, I guess it was. I'd have to go back and look at the record. But anyway, that all came about then was when the auto workers and they began to grow. And, of course, because of the large numbers of people that they had employed, where they became some of the largest unions. We never were that successful in closing our ranks, primarily because it was the oil industry, the old Rockefeller groups that had formed the company unions. They were not only astute at it, but they had a lot of money to play with. When we got into bargaining, and companies would sit back, like Standard and Cal and others, and sit back and wait, and when we settled for a dime, they gave them 11 cents, you know. figured it was a penny well invested. They didn't give him a whole lot. The one thing they didn't give him was job security. They didn't have any seniority or anything like this. But it was pretty hard to woo people away from that. If you let people have things pretty much their own way without having to do anything, why, we're all pretty much apt to take that route rather than get in and have to work for it. When guys joined our union, they had to work for it. They were putting their jobs on the block once in a while to make the battle. Long Beach Local is very significant. I know you asked me this once before, and I kind of stayed away from it. I haven't touched it. I'll try to get at some of the significant things about this local union. It wasn't formed until 1922. Right after Signal Hill was found, discovered. There was no oil in Long Beach. There was a local in Huntington Beach. There was one in Brea. There was one in Los Angeles. There was some up in the valley. Several up in the San Joaquin Valley, some in Ventura, where oil had been discovered, but there was none here in Long Beach until Signal Hill came in 1921. And then, of course, that became such a tremendous field. A young Tennessean by the name of Jim Colder, who was working in Huntington Beach, was a member of the union, came up here and took the job as Secretary of Treasury to organize Local 128. And they got enough people to join and got a charter and started operating. And Jim Colder used to get paid by going out and collecting dues by hand. And when he got enough dues, well, he'd get paid. That's about the way it operated. But he built that local until it was a real sound local union. And he was Secretary of Treasury of that local for 18 years. He was a real good trade unionist. He recognized that our union had certain strengths, but it also had some weaknesses. He never overpressed. He would compromise to keep the union secure, as opposed to fighting a battle for that extra dime or whatever it was. He finally lost out. He didn't get beat. He quit. But he saw a handwriting on the wall. It was getting tougher and tougher for him to get it. He had a chance to get a job working for a Bureau of Apprenticeship Standards for the United States government, for the Department of Labor. And he took that as opposed to running another year. But he always was interested in this local. His brother John ultimately became the president of the International Union. A guy by the name of Fred Phillips, was on the staff here at the local, and ultimately became one of our vice presidents. A guy by the name of Howard Geiger, who had joined our union back in Wyoming, came out here to this part of the country, and he joined, and he ultimately became a vice president of our union. That was before vice presidents. We had one in each district. But they worked in the plant. They were, out in the field. They were not paid by the International Union. This local was, although it was preceded by other locals within the area, became the only local union that, after it was chartered, has continuously maintained its doors as in operation. It's always been in existence as a going, functioning organization representing workers. And at one part of the time was probably the size of this local was the International, as far as paying dues to the International Union, paying into the International Union's coffers. So it's got quite a heritage. Initially, when it came into Long Beach, it had in it a number of people who were quite aware of the political niceties of the community, and we were a part of, remember this was AFL days, we were part of the Central Labor Council, the largest single force in the Central Labor Council. We supported people who were leaders politically in the community. So we were successful in having elected people of our choosing or our support, who we supported, city council, things like that. At one time, we even had the former secretary of our local union become a member of the city council here in Long Beach. We led in a lot of community affairs when we had the real problem of the naval shipyards and the fact that they were going to close them down because of the subsidence problem. Our union joined with the workers down there in the shipyards and the people from the Navy in fighting the community, and finally get some people in the civic area of Long Beach to support and fight the oil industry and forcing the water flood program and things of this nature, water injection plan, to block the stop the subsidence, which the oil industry at one time claimed didn't create the problem in the first place, you know. It did, and it's been proven factor, but that, so we were very effective in that arena, in the sense of having a good, a pretty substantial impact within the harbor area here, especially in the city of Long Beach. We never really had our own people, except this one time, really kind of pressed to get a job, a political job within the city. We took voluntary appointments on commissions and things of this nature, but we didn't seek that full-time job until this one guy ran, and he probably is one we'd like not to have, because we weren't really proud, too much proud of the of him as an individual. Although I'm sure he wasn't a bad person, in a sense, but I'm just saying he just wasn't the person that, he didn't accept a full leadership spot in demonstrating that a union person can be a very effective council member. But it's had its impact. This local union has had at one time in excess of 9,000 dues paying members. That was during the heights, during the latter part of the war and right following the war, up until 48. We were a growing local union. And we had a lot of places, plants that were organized, of course, that had been completely shut down. And now I imagine the local union is somewhere in the area of 5,000 members. It isn't the biggest local in our international. However, I do think it's second yet. I think Port Arthur, Texas is the only one larger, but I'm not sure of that. It may be third. But it's one of the larger locals in the international. Over the years, it has offered an awful lot of people into leadership in the International Union, mainly because it's always operated as sort of a small international. It's always had full-time staff people. Whose jobs it was doing almost the same kind of work as an international rep does. And so naturally it has been a training ground for representatives. It has had to look at a broad picture, because here it is, a local union sent offices in Long Beach but covers Los Angeles County, Los Angeles, part of Orange County. So it's got members all in large, and so they've kind of had to have understanding of how and to operate a local of that kind. They've set up the system of the units meeting and people from the local going to be present to see what the units' needs and discussions are. And it's set up a pretty good system this way. And so they've trained a lot of people. The current president of the International Union is from this local, Bob Goss. He joined this local, used to work for Union Oil as a machinist. He went to work for the local, and he went to work for the International Union as a representative, and then he went to work for the International Federation of Petroleum Workers, which was a worldwide affiliation, which was a very growing organization at one time. It's now been taken over by another, kind of through another affiliation, so it's no longer there. We are affiliated with the national organization, but the international organization. But Bob was one of the representatives. He's been all over the world representing workers, Africa, Saudi Arabia, Europe, South America, Asia. So he's had a lot of world experience. I suppose on the international staff today, the guy who is the assistant to one of our vice, the guy who is the director of our human relations group, Arthur Maxwell, member of the Local 128, worked on the staff there, worked on our staff out here, was a former employee of ARCO, refinery. Jack Foley, who is the director of the union out here, was out of this local union. He was a former employee of Shell, went on the staff of our international union and worked all over this district and in other districts for a short period of time. Comes out of this local union. I came out of this local union. Let's see, who else is on the staff? A guy named Ed Duffy, who is an international representative. He's working up in the San Francisco Bay Area, out of this local. I would judge there's, without looking at the list, I couldn't remember them all now, but over the years there's been a great number of people who have been in leadership spots that came out of Local 128. And mainly, as I said, that was because of the kind of local it is. It isn't big because it has plants with companies who have large numbers of employees. It's big because it has a large number of contracts. It's got about 52 contracts in one local union. So they have to learn to administer a large number of groups. You got any particular questions or something maybe I could help you on?
You sort of didn't get to my question. As I said before, I'm interested in the impact on Long Beach. And I guess you talked a little bit about Pat Corbett, but did you know Carl Fletcher?
Yes, very well. Carl Fletcher was the editor of the newspaper for the Los Angeles Labor Council. And I don't believe Carl was ever a member of our union.
He
was in the Central Labor Council of Long Beach. He was a very good friend of our union, and he became active. He's on the city council, very effective member of the city council. Mainly maintained that job because of the support of our union that we had. We were perhaps in the old labor council days, we were probably the most politically oriented group of that council. And Carl Fletcher was a good labor statesman while he was there. Somebody that we could all be very, very proud of.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised when I found out about him and found out he had been mayor and things like that, because we have the idea somehow, from the literature at least, that Southern California was a real anti-labor kind of place, and especially Los Angeles, mm-hmm. after the bombing of the Times Outlet. Mm-hmm.
Well, it was. Los Angeles was a very much of an open shop city. Long Beach was a little different type of a city, because it's not Los Angeles. Right? Long Beach was not open arms, but for the labor movement. But labor had been here pretty effectively for quite a long period of time. There's got to be people around that would know more about this than I do, because they would get back into that period of time when Long Beach was first being formed, from Wilmore City on up. But we didn't have heavy industry here with the exception of...
Well,
oil, really. You had the building trades were sheer quite strongly, and they've been at one time very effectively organized. The carpenters, the painters, the plumbers, this type of work. Not those who went into heavy industry, because really, outside of the old shipyards, Craig, there was no industry here except oil. And Craig Shipyard was, of course, were building wooden ships, basically. And the wooden ships, the carpenters and joiners and shipwrights, both of whom were organized, were the union that was here at that time. We didn't have a harbor to speak of at all. The community itself, simply because there was no real top management, big industry people, didn't have that sort of a vicious anti-union perspective. The oil industry we dealt with, to start with, was not the big companies. California oil industry dealt with a large number of smaller companies. And some of them were very anti-union, don't be wrong, but they were not as effectively anti-union as some of the others. However, the oil industry was born in the San Joaquin Valley, our organization. It was organizing the oil fields when it was in the boom days. We organized the drillers and the roughnecks. And outgrowth of that, of course, is when the wells were finished, put on stream, we had the production workers. Our picture was a little different. We had the old press and the Sun as the papers in language. We didn't have the Los Angeles Times sitting in the middle of all of this. Some people took the Times, some took the Hearst paper. Although Hearst was not a real pro-union guy, originally he didn't fight unions to the degree that he did later, simply because he was wanting to be president of the United States and he wanted all the help he could get. But the Hearst paper was not as anti-union as the Times. The Times was quite vicious in its attitude to unions. Without getting into its reasons and so forth, I mean, its position was not, it went over and beyond just saying that we'd be better off without unions. They were attacking. And so Los Angeles was a notoriously open shop community. And it continued to be one of the least well-organized cities in the country for a long period of time. Now, it has changed in the last several years to the place where now Los Angeles has the largest county federation of labor of any in the United States. There's more members in the Los Angeles County Federation of Labor and the LA Federation of Labor than there is in cities that are much better organized, like in the Seattle area or in San Francisco. Now, they're much better organized, percentage-wise, but the cities aren't as big and they don't have as many people involved. We still have probably less than 50% organization in Los Angeles County of the eligible membership. Long Beach has changed quite a bit here in the last few years. We have, as Douglas comes in, of course, that Douglas was organized and they've got a union shop contract. You've got the shipyards, and the shipyards are organized. So the two largest employers being organized. And then the oil industry, which is also heavy in population, is probably 50% organized in this area. The city is in pretty good shape. The trades are pretty well organized here. The areas that have slipped, and I don't know what this omens, but the barbers. It used to be you couldn't go into a barber shop without seeing a union sign up there. And the cafes, it used to be that you'd see the union shop sign proudly hung in a cafe. We formed a coalition just immediately to the war and then during World War II and subsequently for a period of time up until I was judged in 1950, where we purposely didn't go into cafes that weren't organized by the unions. We told each other. We kept each other informed where the organized places were, where they weren't. And for a union man to go into a non-union barber, go into a barber college, get his hair cut, you saw him do that, you'd almost take him up before the local when he got back to the plants. He didn't do those things. Now our own members do. You know, the Coors beer, we're on strike against Coors beer, and our own members go out and order a Coors. It's the place that we're not getting that message across, or maybe we've cried wolf too long. Maybe we haven't explained the issues, or we've been long in our explanation of the issues. Something has to happen when the people begin to lose their incentive to work together cooperatively. But I don't want to stray too far in my philosophy. What other questions? I think sticks pretty close to what you're asking.
Okay. What happened to the labor news? Why did it close up?
You're talking about the